The month of March, month number 3, and there's one big thing I'd like to see. It came in like a lamb. Don't know about you, but I sure hope it goes out like one, too. Welcome to Spectrum West, folks, where the arts and culture of West Wisconsin comes to talk and sing and make other beautiful artistic noise. I'm Al Ross. This week, we're going to visit Michael Perry, where he creates so many of his wonderful works. He's appearing in Ladysmith next Friday night. Gary Schwartzoff is here to give us a look at the Master Singers and their anticipated annual spring/Easter concert next weekend. Jim Oliver is here with the author and editor of an amazing book that chronicles the lives of some Wisconsin women through their letters to husbands serving their country way back when. It's called Such Anxious Hours, Wisconsin Women's Voices from the Civil War. And music, musicians, and musical groups are a way of life around here. It's one of the staples you'll find on the shelves here at Spectrum West. Lucas Fisher is one of the busiest musicians swimming in our pool. One of the groups he's in, Poor Man's Ridge, just released a new album. A bit of music. And then our conversation.
Lock it down. Where's the advice for you? Bring it around. Space, fill it full of yourself. Your train waits. How long I can never tell.
So tell me about music growing up. I mean, your dad, Mike, is involved in the Chippewa Valley Blues organization. So I will surmise that you grew up with music in your ears, probably
yes.
Music of a different generation.
Very much so, yeah. Both my parents are very into music. My mom is also a pretty big part of the Chippewa Valley Blues Society. I think currently she's vice president.
Well, I'm sorry I didn't give her due.
Well, that's
all
right.
Just that I see your dad more often than...
Yep.
I'm not sure I've even met your mom.
He does all the promo stuff.
So as you entered the teen years, when people notoriously want their own kinds of music because it's what their generation is listening to. How did that work for you? I'm guessing that you liked the music your parents liked.
Yeah, absolutely. The interesting thing about that is I'm also the youngest of three. My brother grew up in the grunge era, and my sister, she was 12 years older than me, so she was influenced by the late 80s stuff. So I had a huge mix of things,
yeah.
As well as I was into the things that were popular. I was really into heavy metal in middle school. But then at the same time, I was also getting into T-Bone Walker and Albert King, Bob Marley. And so I had this really weird synergy of old reggae and soul and funk and blues along with heavy metal and hip-hop.
And you know what's interesting about you naming all those music genres? I think you play in a band that does each one of those. I mean, you're in a lot of bands.
Yeah.
Name them.
Oh, boy. Eggplant Heroes, kind of an Americana band.
Mm-hmm.
We've been on here before, I think.
Yes, you have.
And
not for a while. Got to get you back.
Yeah, we got to put out an album.
Yes, please do. We're all waiting. We're waiting at the store.
Then I play in a band called Acoustahoo, which is with Sue Orfield and Randy Sins, Olaf Lind.
So you've covered the acoustical parts now. Yeah.
And I play with a funk band called Rhythm Posse. I also play with a cover band called Hey Joe.
What else? You're not at the end of this list, are you?
I'm not at the end of the list. I play in a blues band called Code Blue. And then Poor Man's Ridge.
So you and the guitar have a warm relationship. For young guitarists working on their craft, hoping to become a Luke Fisher someday, tell me about the process of, in a town like Eau Claire, becoming accepted as a player who's worthy of public consumption, a thumbnail of how your playing career has grown. I talk often on this show with musicians about paying dues, and that's part of the whole process.
Well, I've got 19 years in on guitar, and
Okay. Guitar
was a labor of love for me, 100%. When I was in high school, I would spend 4 hours a night every evening, often 8 hours a day on the weekends playing, so lots of honing chops. So by the time I got to be old enough to be in bars, which at that time was essentially the best place to get to know people, was open mics. There was a really great open mic ran by Jeff White, and I met a ton of people there, and it gave you an opportunity to improvise with other players. You can hone your craft that way most certainly. But I think open mics are super important as far as trying to get into the scene. You just meet people.
Yeah.
You get honest criticism most of the time. Mm-hmm, some people mm-hmm. are a little too kind, but most everyone's really encouraging. And then you just start to meet people.
In the studio with Lucas Fisher, we're talking about the band Poor Man's Ridge and their new CD of the same name. We have talked previously about all the bands that you're in. What's it like writing for and rehearsing with several different bands? It would seem to me that Monday would be for this group and Tuesday would be for this group. No?
It's not that organized.
Oh, okay.
I do try to compartmentalize my songwriting. Poor Man's Ridge has been more of a writing struggle for me just because I am not 100% planning on singing the tunes because we do have a singer, Sarah Spindler.
Mm, yes.
So it's the first time that I've actually written in mind of someone else singing. I can come up with a melody for me, but coming up with a melody for her is a little more work.
So you mentioned her, and you're here talking about the album, but we don't want people to think you're the most important guy in the group. So give us the names of the other people who are in Poor Man's Ridge, since we're going to hear some of the tunage and already have.
Our singer is Sarah Spindler.
I don't need a life story on each one, but just...
All right. On keys is Billy Angel.
Billy Angel on keys, okay.
Bass player is Brian Trellinger, and our drummer is Jim Herman.
You know, I like this album. I told you that I listened to it on my way back from Madison last Friday. Anybody who likes, don't take this wrong, but music of a bygone era will really like this, because on this album, you can hear some distortion, you can hear some wah-wah pedal, you can hear a 70s-sounding Moog synthesizer effect on one of the songs. It kind of appears that this band for you fills the space that Luke needs some music rowdiness.
Yes, 100%. These songs all came very much strongly from my heart.
Okay.
They are at my core. This band is definitely at my core as well. I didn't have an opportunity prior to this band to really get loud and rowdy, but just because I wanted to get loud and rowdy didn't mean that I wanted to cut out all the other aspects of musicality, too.
The musicality part, I'm glad you brought that up. You recently had a CD release party. What's coming up next? I'm sorry we missed that.
On March 28th, we're doing another CD release party at the Mousetrap.
Hmm.
It's going to start at 9 o'clock and go to midnight. I don't have an opener.
It's way past my hours, by the way. I won't be there.
Well, this last one would have been better.
Okay. Well, keep me posted as to when they are. I'm in bed early.
Going to try and find an opener for it. I haven't lined that up yet.
So what kind of venues does a band like this play for? I suppose summer is pretty good for you. You can play outdoors more often and festivals.
Absolutely. The thing about this band is I wanted it to be a cover band. I wanted to be able to do cover band venues and everything, which we do. We play like at the Snout in Chippewa Falls, lining up some shows here in Eau Claire. We've done street dance up in Shell Lake. But then I want everyone to be comfortable enough to write music together. There will be more writing together in the future. I gave up on being a rock star years ago.
Did you?
I don't think I'm going to sell two million albums.
You're a young guy.
I don't plan on traveling the world, but I think that the better music we can have out there and the more community we can make in the scene, the better it will be.
I mean, music is so often a right place, right time thing. If you keep working at being good at what you do, you could be in the right place at the right time. And then Katie bar the door, man. The band is Poor Man's Ridge. We have heard some music, and we're going to hear a little bit more right now. Luke Fisher, is that okay, Luke? Is that
all right? Yeah, Luke's fine.
Lucas Fisher, thanks for coming in.
Oh, thank you, Al.
If you weren't awake, you're awake now. Poor Man's Ridge. That's the title tune. Same name as the band. Coming up, we're going to have some fun with Michael Perry, and the Master Singers are working on another masterpiece concert here on Spectrum West. Support for WPR comes from Charter Bank of Eau Claire, a locally owned community bank, now offering new checking account options with personalized customer service. More information is available at charterbank.bank. Support also comes from Markport Toyota, offering the fully redesigned RAV4 with all-wheel drive and new safety features, located off Highway 53 between Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls, or at markporttoyota.com. Support also comes from Art Z Gallery in Amory, presenting the annual Timber and Iron Show in March with furniture, photo and caustic mixed media, hand-forged ironwork, and enameled copper. More is at artzgallery.org. By the way, an addendum to that Art Z Gallery announcement, there's a special Meet the Artists event coming up next Friday, March 13th, from 5 to 8 p.m. All the details online, again, at artzgallery.org. Well, Jim Oliver found himself another great book, digested the contents, and as usual is kind enough to share it and his conversation with the person responsible for its publication.
Joanne Daly Carr is a librarian and director emerita of, retired director emerita of Media Education Resources and Information Technology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Education. In the book, Such Anxious Hours, Wisconsin's Women's Voices from the Civil War, which she has edited, Joanne Daly Carr has put together the letters and diaries of eight Wisconsin women, which tells their stories of events from the home front. The book was released in December by the University of Wisconsin Press. Joanne Daly Carr joins us by telephone from Madison to talk about how she was able to find so much material from a time when the works of women were not always so available. So what got you started in accumulating these letters?
Well, thank you for having me on your program today. I actually got started with this idea when I went through a program at the Fitchburg Public Library where individuals who had developed books based on the letters of men presented about their books. That prompted me to ask the question, but what about the women? And what I found, the women's letters and journals were out there, but they were much, much harder to find than the letters of the men. That prompted me to tell the women's story and share their voices.
How did you go about doing that?
Well, I had a couple of approaches. I looked at publications that are out there that talk about the writings of women during the Civil War, but what was most productive was I went to the WorldCat database, which reflects the holdings of libraries across the world, and read the descriptions of 2,800 archival Wisconsin writings during the Civil War. And the reason I had to read the descriptions is women are hidden in those collections. They are most often listed under the name of the family or under the name of the male who received the letters. So I read, as I said, 2,800 descriptions of collections, and these descriptions can go on for a few pages, to identify those collections that had women's letters in them.
How long did it take to finally get the book published?
It was a five-year project. Mm-hmm. Most of that was indeed locating the letters from women. I have eight women in this book, but I identified closer to 30 women. A few women have had their letters published in whole or in part before, typically as part of a document that also contains letters from men during the war. But most of the women in this book, their voices are being revealed for the first time.
Mm-hmm. These eight women, they're all from the southern part of Wisconsin, is that right?
Yes, they are from the southern third of the state, because these are the women whose writings were able to provide a sustained narrative of the war. I wanted to have a narrative of the home front, the surrender of Fort Sumter to assassination of Abraham Lincoln. And the other letters that I found were very, very scattered. One from 1861 and another one from 1865, or just a single letter, and so it really didn't contribute to the narrative. So So that's why these eight women were chosen. But at the same time, most of the population of the state in 1861 was in the southern third, so they are reflective of the population at that time.
This is Joanne Daly Carr. I like to call her the author. She's apparently referred to as the editor of the book Such Anxious Hours, Wisconsin's Women's Voices from the Civil War. If you want to run down who each of these ladies are without getting into too much detail, we want to leave something for the readers.
The eight women range in age from 17 to 43 when the war began. In my mind, I kind of pair them. The first two women, Emily Quiner, whose journal is a large part of the book, and Annie Cox, were both 21-year-old women living in Madison when the war began. Even though they lived only three-quarters of a mile from one another, they had very, very different experiences during the war. The next two women are two sisters from Winneconne, Wisconsin, Susan Brown and Ann Waldo. Again, they had very, very different experiences. Susan's letters are to Ann. Ann's letters in the book are letters that she wrote to her husband while he was at Camp Harvey in Kenosha, and then also when he was at the war front. Then my next two women are Margaret McNish Patchen, who was a farmer with her husband and her sons near Wyseema, Wisconsin. Margaret was pregnant with her eighth child when the war began, so when her husband and then son went off to war, she had a lot to deal with, farms and a newborn and just adjusting to life without her family that she depended upon a great deal. And the other farmer in the book is Sarah Jane Powers, the mother of three young children. She had been married for 6 years when her husband went off to war. And again, she had responsibility for the children, did move into Fond du Lac with her parents, but it has descriptions about the use of farm equipment since so many men were away. And then my last two women are my two young brides. They were Mary Burwell, who lived with her husband Andrew on a farm near Endeavor, Wisconsin, and Rosabella Augusta Arnold Sleeper, who was single when the war began, and late in the war got married to Hiram Sleeper, who very soon after enlisted and sent away to the front. So the last two women were really adjusting to life without their husbands very, very early in their marriage.
Did you find that these women were pretty well educated for the times?
Yes, and well, Wisconsin as a whole seems to have had a lot of well-educated women, and part of that is the Scandinavian influence. But all of these women were well-educated. Emily Quiner was a school teacher. Annie Cox was a school teacher. Susan Brown was an incredibly intelligent woman. She was a school teacher. And Ann Waldo, her sister, was also a school teacher. Hmm. Now, Margaret McNish Patchen was not as educated as the others. And in her letters, she often struggles with writing to her family. And at one point says, "I would not do this for anyone but you."
One thing that struck me, the women who were stuck on the farm, was there an indication of why the farmers went off and enlisted in the service?
Well, there were differing reasons. For some, it was just the burst of patriotism at the beginning of the war. You know, it was supposed to be a short war. The first enlistments were for 3 months. They were going to go off, you know, put down the rebellion, come back home. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it turned out to be different than that. Mm-hmm. So it's that burst of patriotism. There was also a lot of societal pressure to enlist, that it is your duty as a citizen to do this. And there was the threat of the draft. Although very few individuals actually were drafted, there was, during the war, the first draft of soldiers in our nation's history. And so there were some soldiers who had no choice. They enlisted before they were drafted because they knew from reports that people who waited to be drafted were treated more poorly than those who did enlist.
You expressed some regret in the lack of letters from women of color and women of northern Wisconsin. You alluded to that earlier, but could you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, I really wish that I had been able to find letters from indigenous women for women of African American descent. But part of that is a function of how few individuals in those groups were in the state at the time of the Civil War. Mm-hmm. The 1860 census lists about 1,100 indigenous Americans and 1,100 Americans of African American descent. A lot of Native peoples were not counted. If they were on a reservation or members of the Winnebago or Potawatomi tribes, they weren't counted at all in the 1860 census. And since they weren't counted, they really were removed from the rest of what would be seen as the civilized part of the state, and did not have the education. Also, looking at the fact that there were 2,800 collections and I found 30 women, it tells me a lot of letters from women did not survive the war. And there's a variety of reasons for that. And so since there were indigenous and African-American soldiers from Wisconsin, it is likely that there were some letters from women in those groups, but they probably did not survive the war.
So where is the book available?
Oh, my goodness. The book is available lots of different places. It can be ordered directly from the University of Wisconsin Press, through Amazon, through Barnes & Noble, Google Books, as a Kindle title. And I happen to know it's available in a number of libraries throughout Wisconsin at this point.
Uh-huh. Well, the book is Such Anxious Hours, Wisconsin Women's Voices from the Civil War. We've been talking to I prefer to call her the author. I guess she's technically called the editor. Her name is Joanne Daly Carr. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you, Mr. Oliver, as usual. Here's a Spectrum memo for you. The Red Cedar Symphony Orchestra welcomes special guest Namji Kim on piano for the concerts called Patriotism and Busy Fingers, coming Saturday evening to Shatek Lutheran Church, and then 4 p.m. Sunday to Bethany Lutheran in Rice Lake. Tickets available at the door. And remember, 21 and under get in free. Well, the Master Singers are in rehearsal for their annual spring celebratory concerts, the Eau Claire versions of which are just around the corner. And director Gary Schwartzoff answered the call to provide a preview and more. Welcome back.
Thank you, Al.
You know, before we get to the meat, I want to hear more about the Master Singers as a music aggregation. Membership, what kind of commitment does it take to be a Master Singer?
Well, you have to show up for rehearsal.
Yes. And how many of those are there?
Typically 12 or 14 per concert, concentrated as opposed to drawing it out over more months.
Yeah.
And for that reason, we meet on all Mondays when we get going, and about half to two-thirds of the Thursdays. So we started about the third week of January, and we're going to be done the third week of March. There's really about 8 weeks in there to get this work up to standard and ready to go. Mm-hmm. So that probably is the biggest commitment. We meet at 5:15 in the afternoon, which I like. I think they like that because you can come from work. And then if you have something in the evening, you can still make it as opposed to being out of it or infringing on weekends.
I'm glad you brought up the phrase up to standard, because the Master Singers are kind of a group of perfectionists. You have to live up to the word master.
We're just trying to be true to the score, true to ourselves, and uphold the standard that has been set.
I'm guessing there are a whole bunch of Master Singers out there who don't know that they fit the description. Has that been the case?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah? Yeah, absolutely so. Finding new members is a great challenge. This year, we've been short on first sopranos. My wife and I have reached out to at least 20 possible who we believe to be candidates, but too busy, blah, blah, blah. Mm. We still have openings in the area, but we are currently having registration for the 28th season, so all are welcome to take a look.
I have talked about the benefits, health, emotional, spiritual, of singing with vocalists and instructors over the years. Tell me about that effect on Gary Schwartzoff. What has singing, doing it yourself and observing others doing it, what has that added to your life? Here's a secondary thing to that. If you hadn't become a vocal instructor, mentor, educator, what did little Gary Schwartzoff, which I have sympathy for, because it had to be tough as a kid to learn how to spell your last name. What did little Gary Schwartzoff want to be when he grew up?
Well, there are 8 children in our family. Ooh. So, and they came in what I call 2 quartets. There's an older quartet.
Really?
And mom took off about 4 years, and then they have 4 more.
All singing?
Well, no. Well, no. Yes. They all sang in the church choir, that sort of thing, or school choirs. Probably as a youngster, at the top of the list, after being a cowboy, would have been to have been a farmer.
Oh, yeah, really?
Follow my father's footsteps. I really had an appreciation for what it is, and still do, what they do, how tough that is. I have 2 brothers that took over the farm.
Was it a dairy farm?
Dairy, beef, hog, chicken, you name it.
I've heard several ways to call Holsteins. How did you do it on your farm?
Get over here. Whistle at them.
Because I would think that there would be a singing way to get them.
No, we didn't have a musical.
Did you sing in the milking?
We didn't have a musical vocabulary. We did have a radio on the barn always.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember the day that singing became it? Do you remember when you said, yeah, this is what I'm going to do? I'm going to teach it and I'm going to...
Well, from my youth, early days in the church, following being an altar boy, everyone wanted to be in the church choir. My aunt, Leonita Schulte, was a choir director. So I loved doing that and being there with them. And then moving into high school, as to the moment when it crystallized, I would say it was the summer of my junior year. I convinced my parents, which was no small feat, to allow me to go by bus to Iowa City, Iowa, at the University of Iowa, to go to the summer music camp.
Mm-hmm.
For a week-long choral workshop, which included theory and piano and all this, and a choir. And that gentleman, Dr. Daniel Moe, made such an impression on me that I knew.
You knew at
the end
point.
Of that summer, yep, this was it.
Good. Glad I asked all of that. Gary Schwartzoff with us. He is representing the Master Singers, as he does so eloquently and so often. He responds positively every time we ask him to come in and yak. The concert is Choral Images, Luke's The Dawn from On High. First Congregational United Church of Christ, Eau Claire, Sunday, March 15th. You are in Minneapolis the day before that. And then the following Saturday, the 21st, you're at the Pablo Center with the Eau Claire Chamber Orchestra. All the same stuff?
The major work is the same. We're doing, in addition to that, 6 other pieces that we're performing on our concert on the 15th at the Basilica in Minneapolis. And so, yes, but the major work, I think our 2 ensembles are quite well fitted to collaborate together, and I'm very pleased that we have done multiple works over the years, and I'm pleased that we're doing this again this year.
It's perceived, isn't it, as an Easter concert,
It's... Choral Images is just we call each year a Choral Image concert, like the Fall America My Home, just the namesake, and then whatever the piece is after that. Yes, it's perceived an Easter concert.
Okay. Actually, it's a month before Easter this year, Easter being kind of late this year. What do you look for when you plan this specific spring concert? What are you searching for? Inspiration?
Well, first of all, we're searching for something that is a major work in the area of maybe a half hour. This piece here is roughly 40 minutes. It's a 5-movement work that's accessible to a chamber-size choir that would have multiple orchestrations. When we, the Mass Singers, do our concert on the 15th, we're performing this with a chamber orchestra, which has, I think there are 8 players, wind and string, and then we're using the wonderful organ at First Congregational Church as the bulk of the orchestra. Mm-hmm. Now, when we perform this in the Echoes concert, there's no organ. They're using all wind and stringed instruments, so there's many more players on their concert. Having that makes it so much easier to perform and to take on the road. So we go to Minneapolis, it'd be very hard to take an orchestra up there with us.
Sure.
So the organ makes it possible to travel with the work. And then that'd be something seasonal. Yes, this Luke's The Dawn from On High is certainly that. And there are things about this piece in particular that fit into the Easter theme and spring.
Yes. Robins, groundhogs, and the Master Singers. Those are all signs that spring's here.
Well, there you go. This piece itself is a musical metaphor for a day in the life of mankind, from dawn in the morning through the sun's high point in the sky and then setting of the sun in the horizon at the end of the day. So it's all about light, Luke's. musically, it includes liturgical chant, which personally is a great interest of mine. There is scripture involved here. There is a movement of the Mass included here, as well as there is a modern love poem in the piece. So it's a juxtaposition of lots of different things about light and love and all of humanity that I think is very interesting. This major work is in the area of 40, 42 minutes, and then we have six additional scores.
Oh, you do?
Shorter octavos.
Sure.
So there's a first and a second half to the program. The second half involves a host of works which focus also on light.
Okay.
We're doing a piece entitled Still With Thee by Elaine Hagenberg, a composer we've commissioned next year for this concert to write a 4 or 5 movement work with strings, keyboard, that currently is being constructed. Even When He Is Silent by Kim Arneson, The Old Church, a standard by Stephen Paulus, Tonight Eternity Alone, Rene Clausen from Concordia. This is the month of the Irish, Danny Boy.
Ooh.
The Basilica always asks for that piece.
Cool.
In Minneapolis. So although it's not listed on our program, we'll probably sing it in our spring concert.
Good.
And the African-American folk song, I Believe This Is Jesus by Undine Moore.
Wonderful program.
So that's the other part of the program.
And so after this concert, you kick back for a while, and or do you already have the 28th season pretty well spelled out?
Well, we have a commissioned composer set who will write a setting of a Christmas carol for the Lesson and Carols concert. Elaine Hagenberg will be the featured composer in that spring concert, and the rest of it yet to be searched for and named. Our library always remains a part of our programming, obviously, but also the search for new and interesting scores. If in the process of meeting the needs of programming for this ensemble and then the greater community that which you serve as well, if you can do those things and add commission works to it, you're adding to the body of work that's available for all to enjoy and use should they wish. Elaine Hagenberg is really quite the rising national star, so it's very nice to be involved with that.
We're looking forward to this year's Choral Images concert. Again, it is Sunday, March 15th in our neck of the woods, 2 p.m. at First Congregational UCC. And the following Saturday at the Pablo Center, the Master Singers perform with the Eau Claire Chamber Orchestra. Gary Schwartzoff, always a pleasure.
Thank you all.
Tickets online at themastersingers.net. Spectrum West on WPR, where support for WPR comes from Charter Bank of Eau Claire, a locally owned community bank, now offering new checking account options with personalized customer service. More information available at charterbank.bank. Support also comes from the Chippewa Valley Symphony. Pianist Kenny Broberg joins the orchestra for its Brahms in Spring concert Saturday, March 14th in the Pablo Center at the Confluence. Tickets and info at pablocenter.org. By the way, Nobu will be on the show next week to talk about that concert and symphony. Michael Perry, Mike to me, unless he wants to start calling me Alan, in which case I will reciprocate, is a rather household name in western Wisconsin and with each new venture, beyond. He's written books that zip off the shelves. He finds funny as well as touching ways of looking at things. He sings and, thanks to me, plays the guitar. Now, that's a bit of a stretch, but I like to say it anyway. And he manages to do all that while maintaining a bucolic existence with a family in the boondocks. Because the sticks, and I use that term respectfully, is where he was raised. I allowed my phone to lead me to his rural address the other day for a bit of fun. You know what's really weird about this week's show, Mike? We have the Master Singers on, and you're listed as a master storyteller.
Really?
The publicity for your Ladysmith appearance says Master Storyteller on it. He's squinting, folks.
But I can't read that anymore.
Uh-oh, it's glasses time.
I'm in that stage now where I need the 1.5s working on the computer and looking at the monitor. But then if I do editing where I'm actually staring at the paper, I need the 2.0s.
What does the crowd look like when you're on stage? Are there details, or are these just blurry, little round heads?
No, my vision is good at a distance yet. Like, I can see deer when I'm hunting. Yeah, I can read signs, and I can see people. The problem when you're speaking is you have to have the glasses on to read what's on the podium, and then when you look up, then the audience is blurry because you're looking at them through magnifying glass. You probably look somewhat like a confused owl.
I'm going to talk about my surroundings here because I I've only been here one other time, maybe two other times. Might have been up here for your wedding and one other time I visited.
You were here for my wedding and you were here because you hung out with my brother, Jed, as I call him in the books. And then you were here on your motorcycle once.
What I labeled this as on the promos is we're going to visit the literary lair of Michael Perry. And it's still tough for me to call you Michael, but I know that that's who you are. But I should let people know, if people don't know, you and I go back a ways. And I used to hang out with the 20-something Mike Ryan, which was his pseudonym at the time. And now it's the 50-something Michael Perry. Give me the difference between the 20-something and the 50-something. Where have you been?
You know what it is? It's horizon is the difference. So when I met you, I remember the day. I came over to the radio station with my little self-published book called How to Hypnotize a Chicken. Mm-hmm. I had a pen name at that time. I called myself Michael Ryan because I didn't know anything about writing or how to do it, and I just assumed you had to have a pen name. I thought maybe Michael Diamond was a little too much. So I went with Ryan, and not to be heavy, but I had a sister who died when she was six, and her name was Raya. So I chose Ryan to honor her. But when I met you, so I still had, quote unquote, a real job. That was the last job I ever had where I had to punch a time card. I went over to the radio station. Afterwards, we shot the breeze, and then we went to the Maple Manor Cafe, and they had chicken soup.
Chicken dumpling.
Right. See, this is where the... We really are the old married couple. Well, you have an always chicken dumpling.
But well, you got the place right. That's the most important thing. That was our first date.
That was our first date. So back then, I still had a job. Then I quit my job shortly after that, started freelancing, and you and I worked together on a bunch of cool projects.
Yeah, and you, at the time, lived in a little hole in the wall.
Yeah, I lived on Summit Avenue in Eau Claire, a tiny little apartment. I still drive by there every once in a while. But anyways, I was just plugging away. And when I said horizon, nowadays I still don't really know what I'm doing. And I'm not being, I can overdo the self-deprecation and I've gotten in trouble for that. But I'm being a little self-deprecating. But it is true, I'm still freelance. You're still creating stuff and trying to find a home for it, which translated, it means converted into college tuition and health insurance for your kids. Mm-hmm. But back when I was working with you those early days, the horizon was somewhere between 2 to 4 weeks, right? And now things still aren't guaranteed, but the horizon is a little longer. For today's sake of discussion, you know, you got a year to a year and a half where you could bring it all in for a landing if you had to. Yeah, that's the difference.
All right, so the writing part, though, has that changed? Do you dabble and experiment in things that you write yet or still or ever? Or are you kind of still the guy who writes about a lot of the same stuff?
It's kind of a yes and no answer. There's no question. Everything that I write, every perception I have, is still based on the fact that I'm a farm kid from Chippewa County, Wisconsin. That's my original perspective. But obviously you change, you do new things, you meet new people. I'm doing a show right now. I just did it the other night. It's called Half a Star, and it's based on people giving me nasty one-star reviews on Amazon. I got them all gathered into one file and read them all and had to quit about halfway through because it turned out to be kind of a harder slog than I expected. But there was a person probably about my second or third book after Population 485 who said, well, Michael Perry has changed. He's not writing from where he's from anymore. He's writing for his audience. And I remember thinking, I didn't like that he said that, and I think he was oversimplifying, and I don't think he was completely right. But he wasn't completely wrong either. And part of that was, this gets back to me talking earlier about time horizons and surviving as a freelancer. And there's a bottom line, which is if you dump everything and decide I'm going to write books for a living, and you write a book that does well, and with it comes a certain audience, well, I'm going to write stuff that I hope they'll be interested in the second time around. So in some sense, I'd say right now at 55, the thing that I think about a lot seriously, made some notes about it this morning, is I'm still that kid from that farm, and I'm still the guy who was on the volunteer fire department in New Auburn, Wisconsin for 12 years, 12 of the most meaningful years of my life. But I also don't want to become the guy who makes a caricature out of that. So very early on, this was probably when we were hanging out a lot, I rented the Unitarian Church in Eau Claire, and I recorded myself telling the Foggy Crossing stories, and I did a cassette, Never Stand Behind a Sneezing Cow.
I have it. Could you sign it?
Yeah, happy. Of course. You just have to go through my people, arrange Mr. Perry only signs on leap years. So I recorded that thing at the Unitarian Church and got a cassette produced. And then I started doing gigs, you know, like just speaking and hoping people would show up. I also made a little display out of cardboard from Disc Makers or CD Baby or somebody like that. I ordered little cardboard displays. This is before Google Maps. I took a map and drew a circle, and I would drive to every Quick Trip within, I think it was a 50-mile radius of New Auburn, and I would talk to the manager, and I talked him into letting me put my little display of 10 Sneezing Cow cassettes on the checkout, and then I'd come around every 3-4 weeks and I'd collect my $12 and replenish the display. So the point is, at one time, and then that became a CD, and then that thing was selling pretty well. And I remember thinking, you know, if I would just do another CD of Foggy Crossing stories, humorous stories set in this little humorous town, these little characters, maybe that would sell really well. And then I remember thinking, and this, I was still hungry back then, so it wasn't like I was going, oh, you know, I don't need to do this. I really needed to come up with rent payment. But I do remember thinking, it's fun to do those stories, but that's not all I want to do. And I don't want to just be the Foggy Crossing guy for the next 25 years. And I never did another one. And so what I'm kind of getting at is there's a part of me that is absolutely the same guy as I always was. That's the foundation. But there's also another part of me that tries to take stock every couple of years and go, try not to become a complete caricature of myself. And then to get a little more heavy, and this is actually something you and I have discussed in the past, just personally, I have watched, as I've grown older, some of my most revered elders become very bitter and brittle. They don't want anything to change, and they're upset about it. And let's be clear, not all change is good. But I also don't want to be the old guy who's just complaining about how everything used to be. Now, on the flip side, I don't want to be like the old guy who's trying to hang with the kids with my skateboard over my shoulder. But I'm trying to navigate that ground between being the authentic me, but also being open to change. And that's about as serious as I get, I guess.
And that's my phone going off, folks. The host doesn't know well enough to silence his own phone.
There, though, that one's mine.
They went off at the same time. Those are great. I get them from all over different places. So I want to riff on that audience thing. You talked about audience changing, and you write a certain piece, and it attracts a certain audience, and because of that, you will write something that appeals to them. How has your audience changed over the years, since we're talking about spans of years?
They've gotten older.
Go figure.
You know, here's one of my favorite things. I just did a thing up in Balsam Lake, Wisconsin. And then just the other night I did a thing in Stoughton, which is right down by Madison. And the thing that does make me feel good is I sold some books and had some chats with some folks up north there that based on some of the clothing they were wearing, some of the logos, that perhaps we don't agree on everything. But we agreed to spend the evening together and share some stories, and I shook their hand and we talked, and there are things where we overlap. Then I was down closer to Madison, that part of the state, and I get a lot of folks who come there. And I always say, the joke that I make that is actually kind of true is I say a lot of my audience shows up with an NPR tote bag. But the good news is that in that tote bag are some Farm and Fleet receipts. And so I hope the audience has continued to be diverse as in terms of who is around here. And then the other thing is I've had the pleasure of working with some younger artists and musicians who are not in my wheelhouse. I've gotten to work with people whose work I frankly don't understand. But that's good for me. I love the act of creation. I love being baffled. I love discovering new genres and new feelings at the age of 55. And again, not trying to be cool and hip, but just being open to the idea that, well, yeah, you surely hit this point in your life when you realize, when I was young and I used to write about music a lot and I was very opinionated and this is bad and this is good. And then one day you just realize, well, no, that's just not for me. It's not bad. So as far as the audience, I am always trying to figure out how can I continue to grow the audience. On the other hand, I've done a few things. I did a thing recently. I spend so much time talking about how pragmatic I am and how I got to pay the rent. And so, you know, and sometimes I go too far that way. On the flip side, I will say I wrote a book recently called Montaigne in Barn Boots. And I told my editor when I signed that contract, I said, half of my audience is not going to like this book. And you know what? I was right. But it was a book that I really wanted to write. There were things I really wanted to say, and I'm glad I wrote it. And the thing that fascinates me about that book is you can tell from the sales, which are unflinching and unmerciful, that it is not my most popular book by quite a stretch. But not since Population 485 have I written a book where I've received so many heartfelt emails and notes. So here's a book that didn't appeal to a big chunk of my audience, and yet the folks who did get it are moved to write me about it. So I think that kind of answers your question in that it's a blend of, look, the other night I told a story about the beer tent. I've told that story 500 times, but I still love telling it because the laugh is fresh every night. So I'm still doing some of that stuff, but then I'm also writing a book about French philosophy, trying to connect with someone on that front.
Well, the fact that you predicted that the Montaigne book would be one that half your audience didn't like means you know your audience.
You know, you're the first person to ever say that. That's very, very wise.
I'm older than you are.
Let's hang it up, right?
My
here.
Eyebrows are bushy. That's the sign of wisdom. I've told you that over the years.
Mine are too. I just cut them off because I got to be able to see through my deer hunting scope.
So tell me what are you going to be doing in Ladysmith? Because that's the piece we're talking about here. Hey, Mike's going to be at the Ladysmith High School Auditorium. And then I looked and went, wait, no, he's not going to be there. He's going to be at this cool place that I never even heard of.
Well, yes, but now you better check it again because I'm going to big time you for just a second. I saw some emails going back and forth between my booking agent and my assistant saying that there'd been another venue change. Just be sure and check www.sneezingcow.com, the events page, for the latest. But I do get to speak in an amazing range of places. Cool old supper club place the other night, and then because my audience is big enough to do a few theater shows but not big enough to do fancy places, I get to do a lot of shows around Wisconsin and the opera houses that have survived, you know, like the Stoughton Opera House, Mineral Point Opera House, the Grand Opera House in Oshkosh. Those are such beautiful, amazing places, and they're about right for me because, you know, we can get a few hundred people in there, and I'm not quite ready for the Target Center.
I have to say, though, as an aside, you have mentioned this supper club. I find myself pitying you because if you were a different person and were at a supper club, you could have had an old-fashioned.
That's true. I'm a Wisconsin writer who's never had any alcohol, not even a beer and not even an old-fashioned. And I don't like to talk about that in public because I think they might revoke my Wisconsin writer license. I have really overdone it with the brats and cheese curds. So I'm hoping there's some sort of balance.
But can I tell you that they don't have the same effect?
They don't. I don't know if it can make the air, but one of my all-time favorite stories is I was going through a bad time. I was sad and feeling sorry for myself, and I met you in a small-town tavern. That's one of the things I've always liked about you. You know what I mentioned? I mentioned about people with NPR tote bags but Farm and Fleet receipts, and you're that kind of guy. That's why I've always liked you, and you're a public radio guy, but you also love nothing better than to go into a small-town tavern, have a hot beef, maybe watch the Packers, and shoot the breeze. Yeah, and one time I was feeling pretty sad, sorry for myself, and I went to find you, and you were in a small tavern in a small town, and I was going, oh, well, this and that. And you actually showed me a beer and said, you know, there'd never be a better time to start. And That is one of my favorite stories ever because it horrifies people. And I'm like, no, you need a friend who will just look you in the eye and give you the worst advice imaginable.
It made sense to me.
No, it was perfect. Is my squeaky chair really wrecking the
No, it's fine. One more thing about Ladysmith. What is it you're going to be doing there? And are you a little nervous that it's Friday the 13th? Do you have some material worked up for Friday the 13th?
You know, I've been doing this for a long time. And so when I show up to do something like Ladysmith, there are two things that I know. One is there are certain stories I will do no matter what. I can tell you right now, there's a 98% chance that I will start the evening with what I call the beer tent story. Some people have heard it many, many times, but it's this perfect story to start with. In Ladysmith, they recognize it. If I'm speaking in Santa Barbara, California, people love that story because it's universally funny because it's about beer. But also, it's this perfect way to introduce people to where I'm from and who I'm from. And so I will probably start with that story. And then from there, I really kind of improvise. I don't have a set list. I just have all these stories. Like recently, I spoke to a group of master gardeners.
That makes sense, being the master storyteller.
That's right. Well, and definitely the non-master gardener. But in that case, you know, I spent time before showing up going through my books and my essays and finding a couple things I'd written about gardening, and some reflective, some about what an awful gardener I am.
So what color is your thumb?
My thumb is not green, nor is it black. It is just kind of wilty. Like the stuff comes up, but then it just never quite turns into what I hoped.
Yeah. It wouldn't be wilty if you wouldn't keep sucking it.
Well, if you're a self-employed writer, you spend a lot of time curled up in the corner sucking your thumb.
Well, you know, neither of us likes to get too silly when our conversation's being recorded, but, well, that's kind of how our encounters go sometimes. You can see this guy, Michael Perry, with all the great stories he tells next Friday evening in Ladysmith. It's probably a good idea to check that website, sneezingcow.com, to see exactly where the Flambeau Valley Arts Association event is going to land. Hey, the second art lending period is on now at Artisan Forge Studios in Eau Claire. That's through Friday, so you better get over there. If you'd like something to hang in your house or business, paintings and sculptures available free of charge for a three-month loan period. Veering hours are 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Rising star Lena Elizabeth brings her Americana sound to the Wide Spot Saturday evening. Don't miss it. Widespot.org. Coming up next week, Nobu previews the Spring Symphony Concert. Billy McLaughlin and friends coming around for a musical visit. BJ Hollers announces some summer retreats and more. Thanks, Dean, Kate, Catherine, and Jim. Thank you guys out there. You're the reason we're here. I'm Al Ross. See you next week.